You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Barber cited a number of books about time that inspired him, including the classic text by FQXI member Paul Davis, The Physics of Time Asymmetry. Davis is a world-renowned physicist and cosmologist with a long-running interest in the nature of time, and you could read articles about his physics research on the FQXI website. But in recent years, he's turned his attention to a very different puzzle, understanding cancer.
That's right. One of Davis' current roles is as head of the Center for the Convergence of Physical Science and Cancer Biology at Arizona State University. In September, he gave a plenary talk at a medical engineering conference at Imperial College London and described the work that is being done at the center. In particular, he spoke about a controversial theory for the origin of cancer that he has developed in collaboration with an oncologist and an astrobiologist. I caught up with Davis during the busy coffee session after his lecture and asked him to explain what his theory entails and the cancer therapies he recommends based on it.
I'd never really thought about cancer until I was approached by Anna Barker, the then deputy director of the National Cancer Institute a few years ago, and it's her brainchild to try to bring physicists and other physical scientists into cancer research, not just to help improve diagnostics or treatment, but by lending insights from those disciplines and problem-solving abilities. So I rashly agreed to become involved in this, and to cut a long story short, there were 12 centres set up for physical science and oncology, and I'm running the one at Arizona State University. So it seemed like a good idea at the time. If I'd have known the hard work that's involved, I might have thought twice about it. But actually, it's been a very exciting journey of discovery for me.
But what sort of insight can physicists and other physical scientists offer about cancer when it's something that's been really deeply studied by people that have spent their whole careers, their whole lives studying the biology of it, the biochemistry of it, the genetics of it, you know, dealing with patients, you know, working in the lab? You know, what can you bring to the table that they can't?
Well, cancer is a biological phenomenon. It's not well understood. Will we understand it by just throwing money at it? No, we can't spend our way to a solution. We've got to think our way to a solution. That's why it's so important to have people coming in, like myself, coming in from the outside, to try to rethink the problem from the bottom up. We've got to just think our way through this. As a scientist working for most of my career on really foundational and fundamental aspects of science, I inevitably ask the questions, well, what is cancer? Why does it exist in the first place? And what are its deep evolutionary origins? And we think, that is myself and my collaborators, Charlie Lineweaver and Mark Vincent, we think we've identified some of the reasons that cancer is retained as an option in complex eukaryotic organisms like humans.
So you're really looking at cancer from a very different angle. You're sort of going much further back in time, looking at its kind of evolutionary development and asking, why is it still around now? What benefits does it bring? And how does that help? What benefits does it bring? And why is it important to think about them?
I think everybody recognizes that in some sense, cancer is a throwback or a reversion to some more primitive type of life form. Sometimes people say, well, cancer behaves like selfish individual cells rather than part of a cooperative. Clearly, the story of cancer goes back to the origin of multicellularity, which we think occurred about 1.5 billion years ago, because what's happening in cancer is that ordinary somatic cells in the body are defying the normal regulatory arrangements, which is that they are supposed to undergo apoptosis or programmed cell death after a certain number of divisions. They're switching that off and they're making a bid for immortality by having uncontrolled proliferation. So it's almost like going back to the unicellular world. So the question is, you know, what can you do with that? Well, the first thing is, if what we're saying is correct, that cancer is a sort of reversion to an earlier form of life, then we can ask, well, what was the world like at the time that multicellularity first emerged? And one example I can give you is that the oxygen levels were much lower then than they are now. It was a hypoxic world. And sure enough, cancer prefers hypoxic conditions. Cancer doesn't cope with oxygen and oxidative damage very well. And it defaults back to an ancestral type of metabolism called glycolysis, or fermentation, basically, in which it uses a very large amount of glucose, a very small amount of oxygen. So it's another way of metabolizing, making energy. It's far less efficient than the oxidative phosphorylation of healthy cells, but it's very good at making biomass. So it's using a type of metabolism that is adaptive for proliferation. It can make lots of stuff, but not very much energy. And one of the exciting things here, from the point of view of physics and engineering, is that for 50 years, cancer treatment has really been stuck in a rut. It's surgery often is the first thing, radiation and toxic chemicals, chemotherapy. You know, this is sort of depressing that when you look at the statistics, you use these traditional methods, there's a little bit of refinement here and there, and one or two conspicuous success stories, but overall, it's really not very good. But this isn't the only weapon in our armory. We can imagine controlling, maybe not eradicating, but controlling cancer using physical means. And oxygen is one example. If we can regulate the oxygen tension in a particular organ or a particular tumor, then this is one way of attacking the cancer, which is not really chemical, a non-toxic way of trying to combat cancer. So it's one example. There are many others, some involving electric fields and electric potentials. So another that we have been looking closely at is the way the cancer is more vulnerable than healthy cells to infection, that is, disease agents, viruses and bacteria. And this has been recognized for thousands of years, that tumors can suffer more than the healthy tissue from infection. It's just that infection might kill the patient as well. But if this is done intelligently, it may be possible to use viruses and bacteria to attack the cancer and stress the cancer more than the healthy cells, which can be protected by the immune system. And so we're working on that as a therapeutic strategy as well.
Let me ask you about those sort of suggested therapies that you've mentioned. With the sort of thinking about the amount of oxygen in the environment, there are tests that have been done, I understand, at least with animals, on the effects of oxygen on cancer. Can you talk a bit about that? And those have been carried out by independent researchers.
The ideal combination is to have low sugar, low glucose, and high oxygen, because the glycolysis, the fermentation mode of metabolism that cancer prefers, requires sugar and doesn't like oxygen. And so if you reverse that, then you would expect the cancer would do rather poorly. And some recent experiments with mice using a so-called ketogenic diet, which is a low glucose, high fat diet, basically, combined with hyperbaric oxygen therapy, so delivering high levels of oxygen tension to all of the organs in the mice, does seem to be very effective in combating cancer. And so we think that this is a good approach to use with humans who may have late stage cancer that is unresponsive to traditional therapy. Basically, the patients have nothing to lose. You know, it's too soon to say, well, this is a miracle cure. I don't think we've heard of miracle cures a lot. We don't need a miracle cure. All we need is to put the cancer under pressure to extend life. We don't have to get rid of the cancer. They're going to die of something else, to put it crudely.
You mentioned, you know, thinking about human trials in the future, and you sort of said, you know, this might be something that would be worth investigating with people at quite a late stage with cancer and they have nothing else to lose. But from a very naive perspective, as somebody that doesn't really know anything about this, it sounds like treating people with oxygen and changing their diet would be actually much less sort of damaging and have less sort of horrible side effects than many of the treatments that are, you know, being carried out at the moment, radiation and chemotherapy. So why target people at a later stage?
You're absolutely right, and this is entirely political. And I'll give you an example. So we work in collaboration with physicians, and I often will ask, well, why don't you recommend some of these non-standard therapies to some of your patients, where you can say, well, you know, we now sort of run out of options and there's nothing much more we can do, and the statistics say you've got 3 months to live, you know, go home and enjoy the rest of your life. Why don't you then refer them to some of these alternative treatments like the hyperbaric oxygen therapy? And the answer seems to be Unless there have been properly conducted clinical trials and legal safeguards put in place, this is a minefield. They cannot lend their own personal credibility or that of their institution, their hospital, for example, because if it turns out that this person whose life expectancy might be 3 months dies after 2 months, then they get the blame that they're using some quackery and dragging the good name of their hospital or their institution down. And there's another ugly thing in all this, which is money, because drug companies charge huge amounts for their drugs. They make a lot of profits. If you're going to say to somebody, well, there isn't a drug, it's not a drug, it's a hyperbaric oxygen, which is used in any case for all sorts of other reasons, then there are financial implications as well, basically. And so there's a huge disincentive, I think, for physicians to just suggest these alternative therapies. The other example I was going to mention is aspirin. Aspirin is the best anti-cancer drug we know. There have been clinical trials in Europe that show that it is effective against all of the major forms of cancer, both as a preventative and as a slowing mechanism. And you might think, well, why isn't everybody told about aspirin? Why are we talking about $100,000 a year drug treatments when aspirin is being overlooked? And the answer I am told from within the cancer community, well, nobody makes any money from aspirin. You buy it over the counter for a few pounds. And so it's a story that you'll be told what is correct, but you know it's not shouted from the rooftops. And so I'm afraid money corrupts everything. And this whole cancer story is, in my view, a bit of a horror story.
Well, if sort of the oxygen therapy is thought to be controversial, then the other one that you mentioned is even more so, which is giving people sort of infections in order to target the cancer. And, you know, this is something that you say has a very long history, but it sounds like something that will be very, very difficult to get people to research now. Or am I wrong? Are people researching this in some capacity?
So you're right. This sounds sort of pretty barbaric. Now, one of the things that our theory predicts is that if cancer is a reversion to a phenotype more characteristic of 1.5 billion years ago than to the modern day, then a lot of more recently evolved capabilities in complex organisms like humans should be compromised or jettisoned or divested as part of this reprimitivization of the cancer cells. And one of these capabilities is the adaptive immune system, which is about 400 million years old. So it's ancient by many people's standards, but not ancient by the standards of cancer, which goes back before that. And it has been known ever since ancient Egypt that tumors will often vanish if the patient gets a serious fever or infection of some sort. And William Cayley, at the turn of the 20th century, was mystified by the fact that there were less examples of spontaneous remission from cancer as a result of infection since the use of sterilization techniques. And so he deliberately infected his patients with some sort of cocktail of infectious agents to induce a fever, and found that there was a therapeutic effect. Now, the standard explanation for that is that if a cancer patient catches a disease, then their immune system is sort of boosted to fight the disease, and maybe the cancer gets knocked off as collateral damage. Well, that's going to be partially true, but we think that the story is that the cancer itself is actually more vulnerable to the disease because it is reverted back to this more primitive form, and so it finds it harder to fight off these diseases. And so selective infection of cancer patients seems like a pretty good way to go. But as you mentioned, there are ethical issues about deliberately infecting cancer patients. So obviously you have to plan a treatment regime rather carefully. But there has been experimentation recently, and in particular with viruses that seem to selectively attack cancer cells as opposed to healthy cells. And so there's a little bit of interest now, I think, in the use of microorganisms to infect cancer. So this is still a bit on the edge of cancer treatment, but it's not totally beyond the pale. And this is alongside the standard immunotherapy work, which aims to basically boost the immune system to try to control cancer in its earlier stages. So I see the basis of a whole new treatment regime, which is sort of giving up on man-made chemicals, which is what chemotherapy is, and using instead natural agents like viruses and bacteria to selectively stress the cancer.
Now, you've been talking a lot about your theory and how you think that sort of cancer is some kind of reversion back to an earlier stage in evolution. But it sounds a little bit technical, but I think you have a lovely example that you gave where it was kind of like a computer starting up in safe mode. So can you talk a little bit about that and how, you know, cancer might be triggered, sort of using that analogy?
The standard explanation for cancer is it's reinvented de novo in each organism. If you get cancer and I get cancer, that what happens is that the same disease with the same systematic pattern of behavior is sort of conjured up within the body each time by a sort of fast-paced Darwinism, a dream run of mutations which confer some sort of gain of function on a population of cells. And I've never been convinced by that, and I've never seen the mathematics to support it, that this is really the correct explanation. And to me, what seems much more likely is that, sure, there's some sort of genetic damage, which is maybe compromising some of the regulatory arrangements surrounding these cells, but that's just a trigger for cancer. The cancer itself is driven by an ancient, I like to say, genetic program. That's a very simplistic way of putting it. It's not just a cassette of genes. It's a whole set of pathways, genetic and epigenetic, but an ancient core functionality, a little bit like safe mode in a computer. Because what's happening there is that the computer suffers some insult or stress, so it defaults back to its core functionality and divests itself of a lot of the bells and whistles that are associated with the more sophisticated later additions. And life is like that. We've got lots of sort of little tricks that have evolved over the last few hundred million years. The cancer divests itself of that. It goes back to that ancient core functionality and it's running on that safe mode. And that provides both a strength and a weakness for cancer. Its strength is that it's protecting its core functionality, which is proliferation. Most treatments target the proliferative prowess of cancer because chemotherapy typically targets cells that are proliferating rapidly and tries to kill those cells. But, you know, life has had nearly 4 billion years to perfect insults through its proliferative ability. So really that's targeting the strength of cancer. What you really want to do is target the weaknesses. And the weaknesses are going to be those things that cancer has jettisoned or has had removed in part of this default back to this core functionality. By running on safe mode, it can't do all these later sophisticated things. And these involve, for example, a whole series of efflux pumps. One of the things that cells have to do is pump out stuff that might threaten them, and that includes chemicals. So chemotherapy struggles against the cell's natural tendency to just pump the toxins right back out again. But if cells revert back to an earlier, more primitive form, then a lot of the more recently evolved efflux pumps won't work. So then the question is, you know, which ones evolved recently? Well, you can tell that by looking at the genes that control these efflux pumps. So we predict that as cancer progresses, it runs on more and more ancient genes, and the more recently evolved genes get downregulated or damaged in some way. And we can predict which they are by looking at the ages of the genes. So the key to our theory is looking at the ages of the genes responsible for cancer.
So now we're really talking about tests of your theory that could be carried out, you know, very soon and quite easily. So are there plans to kind of look into this, to look into gene ages? Is this something that people at your centre are working on or that you hope other people will be able to look into now?
Yes. So the short answer is it's easy enough to test some of these basic ideas just from data mining, because we have the Cancer Genome Atlas, for example, that is telling us which genes are active in cancer. And then we have phylostratigraphic data, that is various databases that look at genes that we have in common with mushrooms and, you know, fruit flies and all that sort of thing. And we can trace back how far back these genes go. In other words, we can put an age on these genes. And these are two data sets that have never been combined together before. And we're trying to do that. Doesn't cost much money. It's a data analysis exercise. And so we're trying to do that. The field is a mess. The Cancer Genome Atlas is all over the place. Even the labeling of the genes can be ambiguous. And so we're trying to sort our way through that. But that's one way that we can go. The experimental tests would, of course, be much more welcome. We're making predictions about how cancer cells will respond to oxygen, for example, or how their efflux pumps will be up or down regulated. And we would very much like those experiments to be done. It's really hard to get funding in this field. You might think in a the cancer industry that has so many billions sloshing around in it, a little bit of money could be found to do some experiments in these sorts of new areas. You wouldn't believe how hard it is to actually raise funding to do anything non-standard. And one of the depressing features about cancer research is how everyone's following everyone else down the same pathway. And doing anything a little bit out of the ordinary that costs money is a very, very hard thing to do.
That was Paul Davies talking with Zia about the merits of an interdisciplinary approach to fighting cancer.
There's an extended version of that interview on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. There, you'll also find a link to an article about Davis' research that I wrote for Scientific American and his new paper in bioessays outlining these ideas.